91.3, it's Voice of the Cape Drive Time. Welcome back to the show. Yesterday, or on Tuesday, we spoke to a Yemeni journalist who described the conflict in the area as all-out war. Those were his words. Last night and today, we heard that a coalition led by Saudi Arabia has launched airstrikes on Houthis in the area, and particularly the capital of Sana'a. The strikes come as Yemen was coming closer and closer to all-out war, as our journalist said, after months of turmoil, as fighters and army units allied with the Houthi movement threatened to overrun the southern port of Aden, where the besieged president, Abdu Rabu Mansour Hadi, had gone into hiding. Online is Varian Khan. She's editorial director from the Terrorism Research and Analysis Consortium. Varian Khan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's getting quite difficult now to make head or tail of what's happening in Yemen, isn't it? Because things have been moving quite quickly, and now we see intervention by Saudi Arabia. Did you predict that Saudi Arabia and the GCC states were going to make an intervention?
Maybe not at this particular time, but we saw the buildup coming up from about March 20th. So it's happened in 6 days. So on March 20th, there was proof that Iran was rearming and resupplying the Houthis. They had stopped a shipment coming into a port called Al-Sharif, and 180 tons of weapons and equipment were on it. The Houthis took over the port and locked it down to unload this weaponry. I think that was a brazen move by Iran at a critical time. 2 days later, the Houthis announced that they were going to march on Aden.
Now, the situation in Yemen, you know, let's try and understand it socially. Traditionally speaking, Zaydi and Sunni, I mean, the Houthis are Zaydis. It's a branch of Shiism, just an explanation to anybody listening to us. The traditional relationships have not been as toxic as they are today. So where would you say they went wrong? Because this is the first time in modern history that one has seen such sharp divisions along sectarian lines in a place like Yemen.
Well, you have to realize the AQAP had always had the Shia on their radar. That is one of their primary targets and focuses. With Iran making this proxy move into trying to wield power into the area as early as September, that's when the sectarian divide really became more and more pronounced.
If one looks at it just from a social viewpoint, it's a tragedy for Yemen, isn't it, that an outside interference can poison a whole nation so quickly?
Absolutely, but you have to realize that the Houthis are accusing the old presidential regime of doing the exact same thing. In March 22nd, the leader, Abdul al-Houthi, promised to send troops to Aden, as I told you. But he also had a very brazen speech accusing the Hadi government of being just a puppet of the West. He was taunting them to come and attack.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that certainly is a very brazen kind of public speech to make. I think everybody would certainly agree with that. There's also some intrigue, isn't there, because the former president, Abdullah Saleh, is Houthi himself. What role do you think he might be playing in all of this?
That's a guess we don't have at this point. The fact that he's left his compound in Aden and is now just sort of safeguarded in some unknown location tells you that he's just as afraid of this intervention than anyone else.
And President Hadi, I just saw before I went on air, news reports were saying that he's in good spirits, but we always hear reports of presidents who are on the run or hiding, they're always in good spirits. I mean, that's, I suppose, that's a stock thing for PR to say. I mean, what news...
It is. Well, and you have to realize this is the second time he's fled.
That's right, because, I mean, he had to flee from Sana'a to Aden, and now who knows where he is, I suppose. I don't know.
Exactly. But even good spirits, we're rest assured of that.
Right. Okay. Now, looking again at the situation in Yemen, some writers and analysts are saying that we are looking at a proxy war in Yemen, that the real battle is not tragically between Yemeni citizens, it's actually between Saudi Arabia and Iran, who have been locking horns for some time now. Do you see it that way?
Well, I certainly see the the Iranian intervention. That's obvious. You have to think about this. The timing of the shipment is key, because during the timing of the shipment that we know got sent on March 20th, just 6 days ago, was during very sensitive nuclear talks. This is a brazen attempt by Iran. They're willing to show that they're responsible for the Houthi action since last September. They are deliberately defiant to the West. They're leaving no doubt that they are the ones executing the Houthi strategy. They seem to not think that the West is willing to either stop them in Yemen or stop them with their nuclear negotiations. On the other side, Saudi Arabia had to, when the Houthis took over Sana'a, they pulled out all of their funding and support for that nation that was dependent upon them for survival. They now have to backtrack because their own borders are at risk. Yes, I do think it's a proxy war.
Now, again, trying to understand all the complications that arise from this, Iran then has now got herself seriously committed to the conflicts that are going on in the Middle East, because we also have to think of Iran's role in Syria. Again, proxies, Hezbollah fighting in Syria. Some people saying their defense of Assad is defending the lesser of two evils. I can't comment on that. Do you think that Iran is now in quite a precarious situation in terms of, when you commit yourself to these things, it can cost you quite severely at home if things don't go the way that you plan?
Well, they're essentially fighting two battlefronts at this point, the one in Yemen and the one in Syria. I do think that it could lead to a backlash at home, but you also have to realize that at home they've been very supportive of nationalism as well. I think that, they don't question as much of, I'm trying to think where I'm going with this, because we're looking at the Yemeni government, the former Yemeni government, saying that if Iran gets a foothold within Yemen, they're going to be very difficult to remove. Iran feels excited about getting this foothold and holding stable ground and expanding its territory. And expanding Shia influence. So you have to realize the war in Syria and Iraq is also a war between Sunni and Shia. The Shia are being targeted by the Islamic State. That is their primary enemy. Iran can feel this heat and wants to expand its own wield of influence against the Islamic State and against what's going on in Yemen.
Layers and layers of complications. So if you just tune in, we're listening to Voice of the Cape, Drive Time. Our special guest for this part of the show is Viryan Khan. She's an editorial director at an organization called Terrorism Research and Analysis Consortium, and they have a database which is quite mind-boggling. Viryan, we're going to quickly go for an ad break. We'll be back right after this.
This is Voice of the Cape, Drive Time. Going places.
Welcome back. Our special guest for this part of the show, Viryan Khan, editorial director of an organization called Terrorism Research and Analysis Consortium. And they've got something like 200,000 pages of analysis and open-sourced intelligence. 200,000 pages. Unfortunately, I haven't read all of them. And we're talking about the situation in Yemen. Viryan, welcome back for the second time.
Thank you.
Now, we were having a look at the situation in Yemen, and before we went for the break, it had been concluded that a proxy war was being fought in Yemen between Iran and Saudi Arabia. and of course that the Iranians are very keen to increase their footprint across the Middle East due to, for various reasons, some of them feeling quite threatened by other movements in the region. But Viren, when one tries to stand back and take a global perspective, I mean, Yemen, I'm sure you'll agree, is connected to Syria, which is connected to Tunisia, which gets connected to Morocco. I mean, everything is interconnected, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you can't take out one piece of the puzzle and the puzzle still come together. The wild card here in Yemen is Islamic militants. You haven't heard much of coming from AQAP, and we had the Islamic State attacks in Sana'a just last week. Islamic State is keen to take over Yemen. It's ripe. It shows a lot of the signs that we saw in Libya before Islamic State controlled regions in Libya. You see even the Islamic State creating, just as of yesterday, battle hymns called nasheeds, just for Yemeni fighters. They're courting it, and Yemen is ripe for Islamic State takeover. This all coordinates with what activities we see in Tunis, what activities we see in Morocco, what activities we see elsewhere in the region. Again, the puzzle doesn't make sense if you take one piece out of it.
Also, something else that I'm sure a lot of people need to be reassured about is that most people in the streets of these countries are law-abiding citizens. Most of them don't want to pick up a gun, and most of them just want a job and a roof over their heads. I mean, am I being simplistic if I make a statement like that?
No, absolutely not. I don't think it sounds simplistic. I do think that when you aren't able to provide the basic necessities of an economic system where young people can thrive, that's where Islamic radicalization thrives.
And of course, I mean, the whole issue of radicalization gets even more complicated. You know, unfortunately, we're peeling a lot of onions here, because if one looks at the studies on the profile of your average ISIS fighter, for example, you can't even generalize there as to why people get attracted to the radical movements.
Absolutely not. There's not one particular prototype that you see. You see middle class, you see well-educated, you see very poor, you see engineers and doctors going over, but you also see, you know, pizza delivery truck drivers going over. The appeal of the Islamic State is multifaceted and on multi levels. They send messages out from every perspective on social media that you can think of, every platform, on almost every topic, because they don't know what is going to attract somebody. Is it going to be the fact that they are, you know, successful battle on the battlefront, or is it going to be that they hold a whole bunch of social outreach efforts to the poor? So they have just this multifaceted approach in how they recruit, and that in turn leads to a lot of different types of people. And it's been the most successful. They're not the very first to recruit online, but they are definitely the most successful.
Viren, how do you manage to assess online material? I mean, I'm a journalist. I'm deluged with online stuff every single day. And I mean, my conclusion, humble conclusion, is that 90% of the stuff online is rubbish. Hopefully I'm not pitching. I mean, I'm sure you'll agree. I mean, it takes a lot of sifting to find something of substance, doesn't it? I mean, how does one cope with this deluge of information?
But you have to realize that What we rifle through every day on the internet is not necessarily from news sources where we have to confirm, vet, and see what the material contains. We follow jihadists and other ideologies directly. We hear what's coming from their mouths. We see the trends that they are following by following them on social media. And we do it all anonymously, but we monitor this very well, and we've gotten it down to a science where we can listen and pay attention. For example, Track was noticing Boko Haram moving towards the Islamic State well before they ever declared their allegiance to the Islamic State. The signs were all there, and we'd been we've been saying it to our subscribers for a long time, that Boko Haram was going to become the Islamic State.
It's interesting you've just mentioned that, because we spoke to somebody on the show who maintained that Boko Haram is going to do this because Boko Haram knew they were going to take a hammering before the Nigerian elections, and this would be a good way for them to bolster their publicity.
Well, sure, that was a good way. I mean, the timing of it might have been key, but we saw this well before that. Mm-hmm. As soon as Baghdadi had taken over Mosul and declared their caliphate, Shekau came out and declared his own caliphate. That's when we started seeing Islamic State flags being painted on Boko Haram's most prized possessions, their tanks. They were painting flags that you could see video that they were releasing that showed celebrations in village areas of where the kids are flying Islamic State flags. Then later on in their media, it was clear they were getting some kind of guidance from Islamic State, because their media efforts changed dramatically from what they were doing. You also see the personality change in Shekau. He went from being this crazy madman with, you know, a whole platoon of people behind him screaming during videos, to a very calm, reserved, and controlled Shekau who was making announcements. You also saw higher quality video. You saw them using high-def cameras, which they never had access to before. You saw them using Twitter for the very first time and disseminating information that way, and disseminating video the same way Islamic State disseminates video, through the SendVid platform. All of this were key indicators that somebody in the Islamic State was helping them with their media efforts well before they announced that they were going to become a part of the Islamic State.
I mean, I'm sure you'll agree, if one looks at the so-called magazine of the Islamic State, Dabiq in Arabic, it's the way it's put out is extremely sophisticated. I mean, this is an organization that's not using Mickey Mouse technology. I mean, you've mentioned HD cameras. The quality of the photographs is good. It's well printed, obviously. Most of us have objections to its contents. But, I mean, it's well packaged, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And you've just scraped the tip of the iceberg. Islamic State, we've been stripping down videos ever since the Foley, the first Sotloff video that we saw, and we could tell by stripping it down with our digital forensic analysis exactly the type of equipment they were using. This is very expensive equipment that professionals use, professionals in Hollywood use. It takes like 20 people to man this equipment, and you don't just know like all of its 200,000 functions. You have to have been trained and worked on certain sections of it. That's why we can see some of the mistakes they make in their video production quality. But to backtrack a tiny bit about Dabiq, Dabiq magazine closely resembles AQAP's Inspire magazine, which is an English magazine that was produced and brilliant on AQAP's part to a wider audience for quite some time now. When Inspire magazine's editor got killed in a drone strike, the quality of their articles and production went way down, and look where who filled the void, the Islamic State, with Dabiq.
Indeed. And, you know, when one looks at the sophistication of all of this, you know, the way that they're using media technology, it does get quite frightening, doesn't it, in the sense that young people, I mean, this is their world. Social media is their world. And this is what is filtering into people's consciences.
Well, it's a watering hole. I mean, you have to think it's got to be more like a meeting place. Similar to like what the mall was to teenagers in the 80s and 90s, social media has become the meeting place and watering hole for all kinds of good activity and bad activity among young people. It is overwhelming. Even Track, with its many editors who comb these direct sources all day long, can't keep up with the barrage of material that comes out on a daily basis.
Varian, unfortunately, we are coming to the end of our discussion. But, I mean, if you were to look in a crystal ball, and I know you hate that question, what do you think is going to happen in Yemen?
Well, I think we're going to see Islamic State moving in. I honestly do think that we're going to see more and more activity coming from the Islamic State there. They thrive on the fragility of a weak government, and you can't get any more fragile than in being in the midst of a civil war. Once Islamic State decides to really become a stakeholder here, it's going to be a mess.
Then those are the words of Varian Khan, who is editorial director at an organization called Terrorism Research and Analysis Consortium. They have over 200,000 pages of analysis and open-sourced intelligence. If you want to go and check out their websites, it's absolutely quite mind-boggling, the amount of information. But Varian Khan, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
You too. Take care.